Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this episode of City Talks. Today, my guests are Dan Graham and Paul Swinney. Dan is the Professor of Statistical Modelling at Imperial College London and a renowned expert on agglomeration and transport. And Paul is Director of Policy and Research at the Centre for Cities and also knows a thing or two about cities and agglomeration. Welcome to you both. So the topic today is helpfully about agglomeration and hybrid working in London, which is the focus of a report that you both have co-authored, which looks at these issues, and it's called Office Politics, London and the Rise of Home Working. So obviously the context is, you know, London as the, you know, in some respects, the very epitome of the benefits of agglomeration, but also in the sense that it was a place when COVID hit, patterns of working were dramatically affected. Many commentators said that A, these patterns were substantive, that they were prolonged, and that they would be overwhelmingly positive, and that cities like London would be hit very hard. So I think it's to explore that context, but also the implications of it, looking at the evidence and the literature that we've got. But before we start, you know, I was quite struck in the context around people taking extreme positions very early, you know, on both in terms of this hybrid working is here to stay and it's quite substantive and it's overwhelmingly positive, and being fairly clear that this had, you know, would have dramatic effects on places, particularly cities like London. I don't know what your reflection on the sort of context or of the nature of the debate. Dan, what's your kind of takeaway on that?
Thanks. So, I mean, clearly we've been through an unprecedented change in working life, and that's meant it's very hard to get a good prediction of how things are going to pan out. We've simply never been in this context before, and it's affected various different interests in different ways. So for workers, it's meant working at home, it's meant less commute time, all those kind of things that people were used to in daily life. For firms, it's meant having less busier offices and so on. So the question is, how's this all going to come together? Not just for workers, but for firms. It's very hard to predict. And I think if we look at the timeline as we've come through this new situation, people have tried to predict from their own point of view at different points in time. And that's hard to do. So I think what we're looking at is what's the long run equilibrium, but we're still in the process of getting there. And that's why it's been difficult to get a handle on what's happening.
I think it's a good spoiler alert for anybody listening to the podcast and then going to read the report, is that you're going to need to be comfortable about, we just don't know, is probably a kind of big message that rightly in many respects where we are. But Paul, just your reflection on the, you know, the nature of the debate that we've, you know, that we've seen. Obviously, we've been part of that debate on an ongoing basis through, you know, through various ways.
I think it's been fascinating to watch how this has played out, and not least, I think all of the media requests that we've had since February, March 2020 on this subject. And, you know, if, especially if you read in newspaper columns or columnist pieces, you know, in June, July, August 2020, you know, you couldn't move for predictions that cities were dead and the office was dead and nobody was going to come back into the office anymore, because Zoom and Teams were now being fully integrated and we'd finally been forced into using these technologies and we didn't need the office anymore. And if we need to interact with colleagues, then we just did it through a computer screen rather than actually doing it in 3D. We were sceptical of that, I think it's fair to say, and this is what the report goes on to look at the reasons why. But it's really interesting, I think, to see how the debate has shifted since then, because we very sort of quietly went from a position of it's all about home working forever to, oh, no, now it's actually about hybrid working, and it's 2 days a week or it's 3 days a week in the office. Now, if that in doing that, we had a recognition, implicit recognition, that actually there was benefit to being in the office. There was benefit to have this face-to-face interaction. And that's the world that we are in now, that we do see that, or there's an acceptance that bringing people together is important. Clearly, that needs to be traded off against the benefits that individuals see in terms of reduced commuting times, reduced commuting costs, and these sorts of things. But that, so that's been the arc of the discussion so far. Question then is, where will the debate go in the future, and where will behaviour go in the future, and what does that then mean for central business districts?
Yeah, well, and we'll definitely come back to Dan can say quite a bit about the existing empirical base for agglomeration. In a sense, you know, that's also a kind of interesting sort of thing. Is that almost a lot of that evidence base has been not ignored but downplayed, I think, in the debate. But, you know, we have good reason to believe that bringing firms and workers and people together does really have economy related benefits. So, okay, so let's start with what's the state of play. So in the report, Paul, we look at the patterns of working behavior pre-COVID, during the COVID, and then obviously where we are now. So just try and paint a picture as to where we were now and where we are currently.
Yes. So there was very little data available on this. So we did two things. The first is that we used TfL data on exits from stations in office districts. So basically stations in and around the City of London to get a handle on what's going on with that. And then we supplemented it with our own survey, because in particular, the data that's been put out by the ONS on this either asks people, do you work fully remote, do you work hybrid, or do you work fully in the office, which is interesting to a degree, but we all know that hybrid working actually means many different things, from one day a week to 4 days a week in the office. And actually, that's the really interesting element about this, about what are the working patterns of people in London, and what does that then mean in terms of where we've come from, but also where we might go as well. So if we start off with the TfL data, you can see that, unsurprisingly, you know, during the periods of where, you know, the advice was not to go into the office, that commuting or exits from these city-based, these office-based stations was next to zero. Now, that's not a surprise. That was, you know, that was the guidance that was put out. But there's been some interesting changes on that since. So we saw a bit of an increase through 2021, and then we went back into lockdown restrictions again, or advice certainly not to come in, and then a bit of turbulence around that. But then from sort of the middle of 2022 onwards, so about July, August time, 2022 through to December 2022, we saw actually quite a substantial increase in the number of people coming back. It was an increase of 40% of exits coming through. And that got us up to around about 70% of pre-COVID levels. So quite a strong return to the office. The most popular days seemed to be Tuesday to Thursday. But there's been a bit of a leveling off of that since. It's sort of oscillated around 70% since about January of this year. Now, what patterns are people working? Well, from the survey, we can get that there. The average is people coming in around about 2.4 days a week. And so the most popular days to come in is 2 days, closely followed by a 3 day week in the office. That puts people, because some people obviously work 4 days, some people obviously work 3 days. So not everyone works 5 days a week. That means around about half of all working time is spent in the office from workers who work within central London. But then there's some interesting splits within that as well about who's coming in. So younger people, much more likely to come in than older people. That's an issue if we think that, you know, there's a lot of being in the office is about sort of working on the job. We have this unofficial apprenticeship program that goes on. If older workers aren't around so much, what does that then mean in terms of passing that knowledge on and developing those skills? People, perhaps unsurprisingly, people are more likely to come in more frequently if they live within London rather than living outside. So that element of, you know, commuting being a cost from a time and monetary perspective, that is playing out in the data that people who live further out are deciding not to come in so much. Now, if we have had a process of people moving further away from London when COVID hit, clearly that is then a challenge in terms of if we need to get people back, or we think it's important to get people back frequently. If they have decided to move further out, there's going to be a tension there in terms of how we deal with that. The other interesting thing that we found was that we asked people what the requirements of companies were in terms of whether they actually needed people back or whether there was no requirement at all. And 75% of respondents, or around about three quarters of respondents, said that their company had at least 1 day where they required workers to be back in the office. Now, the narrative here has been about companies being softly approach. Very few companies have come out and been bullish. I think JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs are the only two ones that have really come out and said it's everybody back in the office. And there's the idea that companies have been very softly otherwise. But actually, it's interesting that three quarters are requesting, you know, at least 1 day in the office. I think 2 days is the most popular pattern that we see. And then we see in terms of a behaviour of those people who do have to come in, at least 25% of people are coming in more days than what they're required to do. So there's an interesting element there about what individual behaviours are too. Now, there'll be a range of reasons as to why that's the case, but it's interesting to see that that's the dynamic that's playing out.
So we've got a kind of a levels are at around 70%-ish or so. And then within that, we've got some variation in terms of the days themselves and those and the people that are coming in on average, but also those tendencies of some that come in slightly more than slightly not, which I think is interesting. So, I mean, that raises questions really, Dan, get your thoughts on the survey where we think we are, but also how does that then play into what we know in terms of the agglomeration literature, right? We've got this literature, not least you've done a lot of the review and a lot of the production of that literature itself and the evidence. What's the state of play in terms of agglomeration? We know cities are good for workers, they're good for firms. And then we'll get into that, you know, how do we think the patterns as we see them are enough to safeguard some of the benefits that we get?
Yeah, so I mean, what we've been able to do in the report is look at data over a fairly short period of time, because that's the data that's available. And that doesn't mean that the trends we're seeing or you know, the leveling off is a static thing that's going to continue. There's a high degree of uncertainty around it. So in that sense, it's worth thinking about, you know, some fundamental questions, which is, why do cities exist in the first place? You know, why do we see economic activity concentrated in cities? Not least because that's got huge costs. It's got costs in terms of land markets. You know, if we think about locating in the city of London, that involves huge rentals. There's also pollution costs, there's congestion. So the question is, why does that happen? Why does it continue to happen? Why is it endured for centuries? And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, there's social reasons, there's political reasons. But from an economics perspective, it's got to do with what people call a process of agglomeration. An agglomeration is just a term that describes the actual tangible economic benefits of locating in a city. And the theory says that there are certain mechanisms that simply become more efficient in big, spatially concentrated markets. So it's easier to find suppliers. It's easier to share facilities, to share suppliers. And that leads to efficiency gains. It leads to a fall in the fixed costs that firms face. There's also benefits in terms of interacting and sharing knowledge and interactions in the labour market. You know, it becomes easier to find skilled workers that have precisely the skills that the firm requires. Yeah. So for all those reasons, larger markets lead to benefits. Now, that's been well worked out in economic theory, but there's also a good deal of empirical evidence that supports that. And so if we look at the statistics, and it's actually quite tricky to do those statistics, but I won't bore you with the details. The statistical models show a significant productivity gradient. So what that means is production is more efficient in larger cities than in smaller cities. And that's why cities continue to exist. And that's why firms are prepared to pay the prices that they have to pay to be in cities.
So from a theoretical point of view, how do you then engage with a sort of, you know, blended model or a hybrid model? How does that get plugged into, you know, thinking about then how the agglomeration benefits would play out, but also in a sense, how would you factor in that? Is the agglomeration benefit, you know, underlying principle of a 5 day a week, is that the kind of underlying principle, or is it not? Because I think one of the questions which we don't know the answer to, at least I don't think we know the answer to, is the kind of model of hybrid working, 2.5 or 3 days a week,
yeah,
is it enough to get us the benefits that we've seen or not, right? I mean, that's the big question we don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
But where's the theory and the framework on that at the minute?
So that's where it gets tricky. And I think when you start to look at the academic literature, which we've got to be honest, is just emerging here, and it's hard at this stage to reach concrete conclusions, there's differences of opinion. I mean, there's kind of two reasons why I think it's very hard at this stage to get an accurate prediction of how much hybrid working is the long run equilibrium. And that's really what we're talking about. We're not talking about the transition period we're in now. What we want to know is, in the long run, other things being equal, what's the world going to look like? And the first reason is that, as I mentioned earlier, this is an unprecedented situation. We've never had this kind of disruption to work before. We've had big disruptions, but not of this nature. And we're still on a path towards the new equilibrium. We're not there yet, and so it's hard to predict. The second reason is that what the academic literature is saying is we don't expect this to be uniform. It's going to be heterogeneous. Some cities are going to change in ways that are different than other cities. And that depends on the nature of the city. It depends on the functions, the kind of work that that city does. So if we look at somewhere like London, which is very knowledge intensive, industry is very service sector orientated, that's going to be a different kettle of fish to other UK cities that have those less of those higher order service activities. But what's the precise number going to look like? That is what we can't answer. And I think it would be dangerous to do so at this point. With respect to agglomeration, we know that there's some processes that might be made easier by, you know, remote working. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, labour markets just get bigger. And if big labour markets are a good thing, then potentially remote working can, you know, help there. On the other hand, we also know that learning and sharing isn't quite as easily, you know, it's not easy to do that remotely in the same way. So that brings us back to a situation which cities still have incredible value. So, you know, one extreme could be everyone works remotely. It's not going to happen. The other could be we're going to return to the world exactly the same as it was before. It's not going to happen. It's somewhere in the middle, but we don't know exactly.
Yeah, no, it's good. Well, coming to it, I mean, because interested, we've done quite a bit of work on, you know, looking at the strength of agglomeration, particularly in the UK relative to other countries. Be interested in your view on this as well. Then, you know, what we seem to see in the data is London performs as we would expect it to perform, but some of our other big cities seem to have weaker agglomeration benefits than we would expect them to have based on the evidence from other countries. So I wonder then how, you know, if the agglomeration benefits are weaker in some of those places, does that mean, how do they then get impacted by, you know, a different way of working? Does that mean, you know, did they go off on different trajectories? I don't know. I mean, what your thoughts on that?
Yeah, point? Well, it's almost like, you know, places like, as we've written and talked about a lot, places like Manchester, Birmingham and Glasgow need more agglomeration, need to harness more of the benefits of agglomeration and are not offering those to the extent that they should be given their size. I think the concern now is that if the pandemic base is chipping away at the benefits of agglomeration, actually chipping away at something that hasn't got enough of already, does that then put you in a worse position? And I think particularly for those other big places, it is about improving the benefits of agglomeration, improving the benefits of bringing people together, trying to reduce the cost of doing that to get in the a much higher share of more knowledge-based industries that are going to drive on productivity growth, which ultimately will put more money in people's pockets in the long term. So it's a tricky one, this one, particularly for those places. Then you've got somewhere like London, which already was very clearly harnessing the benefits of agglomeration pre-pandemic. And it then gets us this question of, well, will 3 days be enough to continue London's success? Or actually, given the report we did earlier this year, where we saw that productivity in London has flatlined for the last 15 years, and we need to try and get that up, will 2 days in the office or 3 days in the office be enough to be able to actually get London out of its rut? I think that is a big concern for the capital. So the nature of there are concerns for both those places, but actually the nature of what's driving it, the question around it, I think is the same for, even though the different reasons to why they're struggling in the first place, you know, this question is as relevant for both of them because it has big implications, we think, for how they might perform in the future.
Yeah, Dan, come in on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right, Paul. I think the other point worth making is that what happens in the future is going to be worked out in a competitive market, in an equilibrium, essentially. And so, you know, as a worker, I might think to myself, look, I'd rather not go into work because that's my preference. But if agglomeration is true, and as I said, we've got good statistical evidence that it is, then having a lower level of agglomeration is going to reduce productivity. Now, if productivity falls, in theory, in a competitive market, wages are going to fall. So that gives the worker a different perspective. It's not just about I'd rather remote work, but would I rather remote work at a lower wage? So it's all those interactions between wages, between prices, between output markets that are going to decide the long run equilibrium. And it's that's where it becomes tricky.
Yeah. And it gets us right into this idea that there is, well, as you would say in economics, is an externality that's going on, a positive externality of bringing people together that the individual worker, certainly in the short term, doesn't realize necessarily, because actually your colleague coming to talk to you has seemed to be a bit of a pain in the backside because you've got to get cracking on with something else, as opposed to actually, but the interaction that we've had, I've learned something from you to improve my job, or I've actually helped you to do your job better, which then improves the performance of the company. You multiply that across the whole of a city economy, then you're increasing the productivity of the city as a whole. But I think this is where the debate was. The debate very much, and the reason why it was all about, you know, remote working forever in the early days of the pandemic, was because it was only really seen through the eyes of the employee, which was all these bad things about commuting that I don't have to do, and now I can unload the dishwasher and I can do a Joe Wicks at lunchtime and these sorts of things in the way I couldn't do when I was in the office. Isn't this brilliant? But not, I think, thinking about those longer term potential downsides of not having this positive externality of the face-to-face interaction, which then comes through in, you know, creativity and knowledge creation and how we come up with new ideas, but also, as you were saying, Dan, too, in terms of this on-the-job learning, you know, which is really, really important. Now, it's the balance there then about how do we sort of try and deal with, you know, quite rightly, you know, there are benefits from home working for the individual, but how do we balance that against, you know, the collective good of bringing people together, but also then the implications for wage, which means that in the long term, actually, it's probably good for the individual employee too. Now, I think then what has been interesting in probably in how the debate has shifted is that when you read the newspaper articles more recently, they sort of shift the emphasis to being, oh, well, we've got to make the office a place which is not just a computer. It's got to be this fantastic, you know, space that people love being in, and we've got to give them sort of free food and all these sorts of things to tempt them back. And so it's not just a case of sitting at your computer and doing your job. I think, again, that approach, and companies have indeed have done this, there have been lots of anecdotes about free breakfasts and things like that to tempt people back. But again, that misses this key crux of the externality that's going on. The benefit of coming at the office is not the same, or working at home and coming to the office is not the same, in that it's portrayed as we have a laptop and we sit at a table and we type away on the laptop and then we stop working. That's a tool for doing people's jobs. But actually the benefit is putting people within the network of a team and having them interact with each other. That's the benefit of office working, rather than, you know, your desk has to be more than just a computer sitting on it. No, your office space should be, and if it isn't, there's a problem for the company, should be about, it's about bringing individuals together in that network and then getting them to come up with new ideas and create new ways of going about doing things. And that's where I think we need to have this shift about the function that the office serves.
Yeah, I agree with that, definitely. Dan, you touched on it, or both of you touched on it, but you talked a little bit about, you know, having to think about these, so we don't know what's going to happen, so we have to accept that uncertainty. So that's one element we need to think about, but we also need to think about whatever the levels are at the present moment or in the future, we should also think about them, like the short-term effects and the longer-term effects. Just say a little bit about what does that mean, you know, when we're thinking about productivity and innovation and creativity, for example. We'll get on to other things like transport, air quality, which we've also looked at, which I think is, you know, is important to throw into the mix. But just in terms of, you know, productivity, how should we think about the effect of, let's say, hybrid working, the sort of 70% model, 2 to 3 days a week working practices? What should we expect differences on productivity in the short run versus the long run? How do we get into that?
Yeah, so I mean, there's going to be some activities which might not be affected by remote working. I mean, let's say, for instance, I've got a report to write. Mm. Yeah, I've just got to get on with it. I can easily do that from home. I don't need the interaction that agglomeration is about. But there's other kind of processes where that's not the case, where interaction, where, you know, travel, commuting, all the things that we do in a regular daily work in the office will matter. Now, in the long run, if some firms begin to realise or see a fall in productivity as a result of hybrid working, they might decide to take action on that. And if they take action on that in a competitive market, that will give them the edge. And other firms will have to catch up, or they will lose a competitive edge. And I think that is, in the long run, it's through competition, through what workers want, what firms want. And that process of competition is what's going to determine the long run.
And quite a bit of the literature, you know, talks about, you know, the means through which the face-to-face creates benefits and value. you know, which is in part, you know, using and being enabled by, you know, issues around reciprocity, trust, social capital amongst, you know, amongst employees, etc., which presumably erodes over time, right? Because we know from the agglomeration literature that agglomeration benefits decay in terms of over distance, right? Yes. And that's a proxy, I assume, for levels of interactivity or interaction, right? The further away from the, you know, from the scene you are, the less interaction you have, therefore the less benefits of. So is that the same? Can we think about that in the same way over time, in the sense that you, you know, you borrow from your existing reservoirs of social capital in the moment, but by definition, those decay over time, and that's where we begin. We might then begin to see productivity impacts in a negative sense.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. I mean, the spatial scales over which agglomeration operates, over which it has benefits, depends on the source of agglomeration. So if it's things like sharing knowledge and innovation, that tends to work at quite small scales. Could even be a street, it could be a neighbourhood, could even be within a building. The labour market effects are a bit bigger. I mean, that's within, contained within a labour market itself. But I think that's right. Over time, we're going to be seeing a similar kind of process where the benefits that are apparent, the benefits we're deriving, if they're changing, because people have decided to do more hybrid working, that's going to become evident. Yeah.
Yeah. Paul,
your
kind of thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, so as Jan says, particularly this face-to-face interaction element of agglomeration plays out with these very small geographies. And if we have then got, you know, not having this serendipitous interaction so often, because people are more distributed, you know, because they're in their homes rather than in their offices, you would expect that there would be some sort of hit. Now, I don't think it's going to be, you know, you only work in the office, you know, you work in the office 40% less time, so then productivity is going to go down 40% as a result. I think that it doesn't feel that's going to happen, because there will be elements of, you know, tasks, as you say, Dan, like writing reports in our world, where sometimes, or going through emails or whatever, where actually going through those tasks and not having interruption is good, or not, you don't require interaction at least to do those sorts of things. So if employees are, you know, saying going through those tasks on a Friday, then it doesn't. If they're doing that on a Friday and they're working from home, then there isn't going to be productivity hits to that. You could even argue maybe there'll be a productivity benefit from that, because you're not getting the interruption. But I think the element within all of this is it requires within that for people to have perfect knowledge about when serendipity happens. Now, by definition, that is impossible. We don't know whether, you know, the interaction you're going to have with a colleague is going to happen at, you know, 4:30 on a Monday or 9:27 on a Friday. And that's where we in particular start to see a cost from some of this stuff, which will be really hard to observe, because, you know, it just doesn't happen. But if it doesn't happen, you don't know what you're missing. But then we'll have this long-term impact, which I think will start to come through in the numbers, but we will not see what the mechanism looks like, because these sorts of things are so intangible in terms of how they play out. So it'll be very interesting, as Dan was saying earlier, about how companies respond to that. Because in the short term, or where we are now, it seems like the competitive element is very much on the worker side, and that we've got a very tight labour market, and a lot of companies are seemingly, we're told, reticent to come out to say anything about, you know, tightening or greater requirements to come in, because they don't want to spook their workers and think they'll lose their top talent to other companies, which is a, you know, perfectly understandable position to be in. But if in the longer term you do see competition changing, so that, you know, those companies that are prepared to do that and then do see a competitive advantage as a result, and again, we don't know whether this, we think that might be the case, but we can't prove that currently. We're running an experiment. But if it's the case that there are some companies that bring people back 4 days a week, let's say, or 5 days a week, and they then start performing better, that will cause an opposite impact through the economy as well, where it'll start to do this pull to be trying to get people to come back. And it'll be fascinating to see how it's played out so far, and it'll be fascinating to see how that continues to play out in the coming years.
Yeah, Dan, your view on that, because there's almost like a frequency model, right? I mean, in some respects, it's like we know interaction matters, and we need to create as many opportunities for those interactions to happen. We don't know how many interactions we need in order to get some of the benefits that we see in the literature. But if we reduce the number of opportunities, then all things being equal, you know, the number of interactions is probably going to diminish as well. Is that helpful, you know, in terms of trying to think about this is 2 or 3 days enough, as it were? I mean, that's a simplistic way of kind of thinking about it. But is that helpful to think of it like that?
Yeah, I think it is. Of course, as we said earlier, interactions matter heterogeneously. Yeah. So for some types of activity, much more important than others. And actually, we've seen that in the history of cities. If we look at the evolution of cities over time, some activities that previously were based in the city centre then start to move out and become more, let's say, suburbanised or more decentralised, because they're not crucial for agglomeration, whereas others then start to, you know, concentrate in the core. So we're going to see that happen, I think. I mean, that's going to be pretty clear with hybrid working. Some activities are probably not, it's not so important for them that a great number of interactions happen. But for others, it is important. And I think another thing, I mean, we'll probably come on to this later when we talk about public policy, but Paul mentioned an important thing about agglomeration, which is it's an externality. And what that means is that I don't really value the benefit that I give to others. It's a bit like the opposite of congestion. You know, if I get in my car and drive on the road, I don't really care about the congestion I cause to others if I'm a rational person. I mean, if I'm a decent person, I do, but I'm not a decent person, so I don't care about the congestion I give to others. It's a bit like that with agglomeration, in the sense that, you know, I could remote work, and I might give benefits to others if I didn't remote work, if I had more interactions, but I don't value them because they don't appear, you know, that they're not apparent to me, they're apparent to other people. So that externality thing is important, and it's important because, you know, even a diehard economist, a market economist, when they see an externality or what they call a market failure, sees room for public intervention.
Yeah. So, and that does exactly. Yeah. It's that connection, right, between the externality aspect, and which leads us to then think about if public policy responses,
yeah,
rather than just saying this is all to do with individuals, you know, whether it's literally individuals or individual firms, just let them make their decisions what they are, let it lay what it is. That's kind of right in some respects, but because the externality benefits we get, there's a public policy question that which is then presents itself about how we might encourage more of something or less of something. That's the way to think about it, right?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, rather just leave it to individuals to figure out what works best for them. Okay, so in the report, or you come back in on this, because we don't know, and we genuinely don't know, and we're pretty comfortable with that, we tried to set out a bunch of scenarios or a bunch of implications that if the current situation, as you've laid out, partial working, 70% levels, if that sort of persists for some time, that may well have consequences and implications for a bunch of areas. We talked a little bit about productivity, you know, as a kind of what might happen there, but we're also thinking about, and at least alluding to, what that might mean for the transport system in London. We've also, you know, there's a real estate question, obviously, but then we're also thinking about air quality and transport more generally. So just say a little bit about, let's start with transport. You know, public transport London is one of the underpinning foundations that enable the benefits to be, you know, to be realized. We have a particular system in London that is very, very dependent upon fares for its to cover the cost of running the outfit. So you can see, or you can imagine, what that might mean. But just say a little bit more about that. Well, you know, what we've tried to say in the paper.
So I think the implications of the transport system are the most tangible short term things that we can get a handle on. You know, the productivity element, we think it's going to happen, but it'll be hard to put numbers around that, and it'll be harder even pick out the numbers when, you know, if and when there is a positive or negative impact. But transport, you know, we can see that already in terms of much lower ridership. It's improved very strongly over the last year or so, but it is still below pre-COVID levels. And I think the issue for TfL and indeed, well, TfL and then bits of the rail operating companies that are running into London as well, is that you're then having to run a network on those reduced revenues, mainly because, as you were saying, Andrew, we've got a fare system, we've got a transport system which is much more dependent on fares here than what we see in some other large cities like New York, Hong Kong and Paris. Now, that creates a budgetary hole for TfL. The government has had to step in and fill that when levels were very, very low. But in the long term, that is there's no signal to suggest that that's going to continue to happen. So that if things stay the way that they are, that puts you in a position of TfL potentially having to cut services. Now, if that happens, then you've got this element of undermining, you know, the benefits of agglomeration. It starts to increase the cost of getting into the office because it's going to take longer to do so because it's not so frequent, or perhaps the journey takes longer, or perhaps infrastructure isn't maintained as quite so well as what it has been in the past because you haven't got the revenues to be able to do that. And then you start having, you know, an escalating problem on that front. I think there's then that sort of a scenario where, you know, we stayed our levels forever. But if you then start to think about some other scenarios where hybrid working persists, but let's say there's jobs growth in the centre of London. So, you know, there are fewer bodies coming in 5 days a week, but actually there are more bodies coming in on a, let's say, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, which seems the most popular times to come in. That poses a particular challenge because then that means that TfL is trying to run a system on a 3-day morning peak with the revenues from a 3-day morning peak, but then has to maintain the system and indeed actually expand the infrastructure of the system in order to deal with the greater capacity on the ever fewer number of days. That will require a different fare model for sure. That will require, you know, an approach to continue to invest in transport, but then, you know, the benefits you're getting from that aren't quite so great because people aren't coming in so often. So that is a particular challenge, I think, that we haven't probably as yet fully thought through the implications of, as a, you know, London hasn't fully thought through that, and I don't think the government has fully thought through that yet either.
Yeah, Dan, come in on that, because in a sense, these are self-reinforcing, right? In a sense, transport enables agglomeration, but if we reduce transport services, i.e., increase the costs of commute, then that's going to have a negative effect on people's willingness to travel. And, you know, it's sort of self-perpetuating in some respects.
Yeah, absolutely. And what Paul said is absolutely correct. You know, agglomeration is supported by efficient transport systems. You know, it's not just about how much activity we have in London. It's about how accessible that activity is. And when we have transport systems that are congested or don't work efficiently, that essentially limits the strength of agglomeration. One way of looking at it is London would shrink in size. You know, that's the arguments that lay behind the funding for Crossrail, for instance. You know, it's going to save people travel time and so on. But ultimately, it also increases the size of London because it makes it more accessible. It makes those markets bigger, in a sense, and that then induces agglomeration benefits. So for all those reasons, I think that's true.
Yeah, so we'll get onto the policy. You can see the policy implications. How do you maintain transport in the short run when the passengers are not necessarily there? Because if you reduce services to bring it down to where the passengers currently are, that then may retard you alone, you know, going back up or encouraging it. So we'll come on to that. Just we'll talk a little bit about real estate, because I think that's quite an important area to talk about as well. But just on transport, round off, because we think, you know, we've done quite a bit of work on air quality as well, Paul, and how, and we've definitely noticed in the COVID period, understandably, air quality actually, in some respects, once we got into the recovery mode, got drastically worse, and that was because people shifted modes. So just bring transport and air quality together, and there's implications for that, right, particularly again in London.
So from the 2011 census, which is frustratingly the most recent data that we have, something that annoys us every day on commuting, we know that 90% of workers in central London were commuting in by public transport or active travel, so walking or cycling. What we also know from work that has been done is that those people who work from home are more likely to use their car in the times where they're working from home rather than use public transport. Now, that's not a surprise for two reasons. The first is that if they're living in a less dense environment than where they work, that means that public transport services probably aren't as good. If you think the fringes of London, or indeed, especially those people who live outside of London, when you go to the shops, we're going to pop in the car to go and do that. But there's also an element that if people are now not buying season tickets, which seems to be the case because you're only coming in, let's say, 2 or 3 days a week, so it's not worth it, all of a sudden people are facing a marginal cost to getting on public transport. So what are you going to do? It makes the car more appealing. And as you say, Andrew, we've seen this in the data in terms of how car journeys recovered relative to public transport, certainly through 2021, and that car journeys have bounced back much more quickly than what public transport journeys have. The implication then is, you know, carbon emissions challenge. There's there's definitely an air quality challenge that comes out as a result. So we're focusing in the report on the economic impacts, but clearly there are environmental impacts that come from this change as well, that you know, I don't think people realise, because again, we've had a number of questions in the past, which is, oh, well, if people are working from home now, then they're not commuting in, so that's going to reduce emissions. It's like, well, that is true to some extent. They're not making that journey, but they are actually making other journeys by private transport, which on balance, it seems, is actually puts us in a worse position.
And that's particularly, as you said, that's particularly acute in London, because we know most of the commutes, high 90% of commutes, are done through public transport and or active travel. You know, where on average emissions per capita are much lower than they are through private vehicle. And if they then don't make the commute, but they continue to travel in their local environments, they're primarily doing that through cars, yeah, which has much higher emissions relative to the individual. Real estate then, right? There's a lot of talk about what this might mean for real estate. And it seems, you know, there's lots of angles in it, right? On the one hand, people saying, thinking about real estate as an investment, you know, prices come down, assets depreciate. But there's obviously an occupier perspective. People have, you know, many firms on relatively long leases, so they haven't been able to realize opportunities to downgrade. There's the other angle, which is actually this is going to encourage a kind of flight to quality. So lower grade quality property get or real estate gets abandoned, and essentially people, you know, if they're only in fewer times, they take higher quality risk. How do we make sense of all of that? I mean, you know, where should we be on that? I mean, what do we imagine would happen?
I think I'm going to pass that to Paul. Yeah, I think, I mean, Paul, there's good stuff in the report on real estate, and so I'll pass that over to you.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting area, because there's an element to you look at the headline rents data, but actually doesn't tell you the whole story. So we've been doing a bit of digging in on that. The first thing to say is that there hasn't been a complete implosion on in the real estate market in central London, especially given that that's what some predictions were saying at the start of the pandemic, that, you know, all of a sudden office space would be totally obsolete, and it was all going to turn to residential, and cities have to become urban playgrounds and won't be places of work anymore. Well, look at the data, that's not the case. We see that rents for grade A space have held up broadly, especially in the West End, sort of fallen a little bit in the city, but not by very much. But the nature, I think, of some of the underlying elements of those contracts have been quite interesting. So it seems as if the length of rent-free periods have increased. That is included in the headline rent, so that is basically a price cut.
Yeah.
We've also seen a shift in terms of all the space that's taken up, what share of it is grade A, that means, you know, basically brand new space or totally refurbished space relative to grade B, so that's previously used space. There's been a shift towards grade A. In fact, I think in 2022 or the year to June 2022, almost all the space was grade A that was taken up, whereas pre-pandemic it was about two-thirds the space would be grade A. So it seems that there's some suggestion there about a flight to quality has been going on as well. But certainly there hasn't been, you know, despite claims that there's going to be large downsizing from businesses, or businesses are going to give up their offices and move away. And indeed, we had lots of news reports about the anecdotes on that, because clearly that was a good news, interesting news story at the time. In aggregate, the market doesn't seem to suggest that that's the case. Now, part of that might be, as you were saying, Andrew, that if people are tied into long leases, there might be a really long lag effect on this. And indeed, I think if we didn't have long leases, maybe we would have seen a greater correction in 2021 and 2022. But if you look at what's happened in the last year in terms of the data, and we are seeing, you know, people coming back into the office, we are seeing a 2 to 3 day working week going on. If we are going to get people back basically in on the same days, because if people aren't in the office in the same days, then what's the point? So it's about, if you realize the value of coming back, then it's bringing people back, but they also have to come in on the same days. That doesn't really give companies much wiggle room in terms of being able to downsize, because they still need the same amount of space to have those colleagues in. It's not a case of, well, half coming on Monday and half coming on Tuesday, etc. So there's not much flexibility there. What that then means from the company, if we're right on that thought experiment, is that they continue to pay the costs, but if they're not getting as let's say there's a productivity hit, so they're not producing as much because people aren't in 5 days a week. It actually means that their profits go down, but their costs remain the same. You've got this fixed cost element, which you might actually mean you see a productivity hit just through that element, that you can't adjust your costs down the same way that you see the fall in productivity. And that will be interesting too. And I think going back to this element of the competition between companies, if we're right on that, how long will it take different companies to realize that? Now, it seems like financial services or investment bank in any way have already realized that and realized that months ago, and that's why they're being very bullish about it. Seems like some other sectors, they're not as affected by this sort of thing, or they haven't realized it yet. And in the data that we've got, it seems like that's more, you know, arts, media, and entertainment type activities, or IT and those sorts of things, less at that spectrum at the moment. And the interesting thing will be, will we just see, you know, a greater difference across companies about which sectors really value, you know, central location and which don't, or these companies that don't seem to be so pressing in terms of trying to get people back and embracing the world of hybrid working, actually, will they remain like that forever?
Yeah. Because in the agglomeration literature, you talked about this earlier on, certain firms or certain types of activities get larger agglomeration benefits than other types of activities. And we can see this in the way, you know, if you just look at the London economy and how activity or firms and industries are distributed across London, you can quite see that, right? In the sense that in and around the city centre, you know, all things being equal, are those firms that benefit the most from agglomeration, not least because they have to pay a higher cost. So we would expect to see further segmentation, I suppose, in some respects, concentration. Would that be the way that we should think about it?
Yeah, we would. And, you know, the important point about real estate prices is, I mean, that's the really tangible evidence for agglomeration, because there's simply no rationale for paying those prices if there's not a corresponding benefit. And it is heterogeneous, and it changes over time. It changes as activities find new ways of doing things. So we're in a state of flux. There's no doubt there's uncertainty. But yeah, real estate is an interesting one to follow at the moment, because it's going to give us some indication of what's going on. And I think, you know, as long as we've got those higher prices in cities, I mean, that's the important point about evidence for agglomeration. As long as we've got those much higher prices in cities, there must be an offset.
Yeah, we have to explain that, right? Otherwise, people are just mad and they're just overpaying.
They're mad. And it wouldn't work in a competitive market. No. Because firms would just say, okay, I'm not going to pay that price. I'm going to reduce my costs, reduce my prices, and I'm going to get a competitive advantage by not being in that location. So prices are a very good indicator.
Yeah.
You know, agglomerations capitalized in prices is what we say.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, let's turn to policy implications in a sense. So you both talked about it. Dan, you started with the, you know, the rationale for policy, or at least thinking about policy, even if before we get to intervention, is in some respects trying to deal with and capture the externalities, both good ones but also bad ones, right? In a sense, you know, good ones through learning, for example, bad ones through air quality and air pollution. So just say a little bit more, you know, when you then think about at the London scale, where does that, you know, how should we then think about policy, and how should agglomeration help us think through what London may or may not want to do in terms of encouraging firms or workers back into the city?
So I think agglomeration is actually one of those areas of, you know, economic thinking, economic statistics, that's actually been used for public policy quite considerably. So already, when we make appraisals of what schemes we should build, Crossrail, High Speed 2, we think about benefits in terms of agglomeration. So it already features in public policy. And I think we need to continue to recognise that cities have those advantages. We focused on the productivity effects a lot in transport, but actually the climate change ones are equally important, and there's now a smaller but growing body of evidence that shows that there are real significant efficiencies, economic efficiencies in energy use and in emissions as city size grows. So I think public policy needs to take that on board, needs to take on board the advantages that cities can offer, and we need to think about, okay, how do we provide an environment in which those benefits can be realised in the best way. And that's going to involve thinking about the infrastructure we have and how well used it is. So there's capacity issues. It's going to be about thinking about the prices that we charge for transport systems and whether there's ways of subsidizing or changing the price to improve things. And it's going to be important to think about climate change. And I think that's the element to some extent that we need to bring into this debate, because it's missing a lot. Some people think of cities as terrible locations for pollution and bad for the environment. I think the evidence is showing the opposite, and we need to recognize that and have that as part of the debate.
Yeah, Paul, come in. I mean, that makes it a great point. Is it, we talk about this in the report. Yeah, the tendency is to say, you know, what can we do to encourage people back into the office? And we often, I'm not saying we do, but often the conversation turns into some of the superficial, but like you said, make the office look a bit nicer, you know, give people free sandwiches or beer, or, you know, on a Friday afternoon. But, you know, what Dan's talking about there are basically, you know, to prioritize and really think about the foundations, the fundamentals that actually affect how cities operate, and the willingness and the ability of individuals, and, you know, however defined, to actually use that, which lends you to think much more about the cost of transport, for example, the ease of transport, housing affordability, and the ability to live in places relative to, you know, to all of that. You know, you start there, then you might get to campaigns and, you know, the London is open, all of them. I'm not saying they're not important, but in the absence of a functioning transport system that is reasonably frequent, reasonably priced, reasonably reliable, those campaigns don't really work, right?
Yeah. So the first thing to say is, Andrew, if you're about to introduce free beer on a Friday in this office, then I'm not going to count against that. I might retract my earlier comments. But seriously, I think it is thinking about what are the benefits to bringing people together, and how do you, well, policy needs to think about what are the benefits of bringing people together, then how to try and encourage that. So there's a positive externality there that we've spoken about face-to-face interaction. So what can policy do in that space? And then you've got, well, what are the costs to the individual of coming in? And then what can policy do to try and reduce or minimize those costs in terms of to induce them to come in? So if we start on the positive side, there probably aren't a great number of levers that policy can pull, which gets us into a position of saying, well, actually, there's some nudge type thing that needs to go on here, which is a campaign which is equivalent to the, you know, Let's Do London campaign the mayor ran, which was very much focused on coming to central London from a leisure perspective. Actually, I think we need to have a bit of a push from a work perspective to get people in, which is, you know, national government plus a collection of businesses to overcome this coordination problem that an individual business doesn't necessarily want to stick its head above the parapet in a tight labour market and say you must come back. But actually, there's a group, you know, a collective voice saying that, maybe that is a bit easier to say and articulate what the challenges are by people not perhaps coming in so frequently. And if we're going to get those people back, actually to maximise that benefits, you do want them coming in on similar days. So there's elements there that I think public policy and individual businesses can be doing to be trying to maximise the benefit of people coming in. But you're very much focused on the cost side, Andrew, which I think is a more important element for us to be thinking about, because clearly that is the barrier that people face. Again, I think there are probably limited levers to pull from a public policy perspective, but within the transport world, I think there are some quite tangible ones we can pull. So the first one, touching on what we were saying earlier, is about at least maintaining the frequency of service that we've got on the transport network, you know, within London or indeed within other big cities. Because if we see a drop off in that frequency, and indeed we sort of see that with strikes at the moment as well, you know, a drop off in the amount of services that are happening, then that makes it more difficult for people to get in, increase the time cost of commuting, which is going to reduce the effective size of the labour market of London or indeed the market of Manchester or central Birmingham, wherever it is that we're talking about. So that's the first point. But clearly there's going to be pressure on TfL to cut those services in the short term if people don't come back, because there's a budgetary hole to fill. There's then a second element, which you were touching on, Dan, around, well, can we do something specific around the costs? Now, again, we're in a tight position because clearly, you know, TfL is in a difficult financial position, and being able to cut fares across the board is not an option. But what we suggest in the report is to whether there's something that could be done around removing peak fares on a Friday in particular, where if that was to be removed and you make Friday commuting cheaper, which is, and coming in on Friday is the least popular day, unsurprisingly, of all of the days, then maybe that's a way to induce people to come in a little bit more. Now, from a financial perspective, if more people start riding at a slightly cheaper fare, it might be that actually revenues go up through doing that. So maybe we don't have a financial problem with that. And so that's something we can do. But it is fairly small. I mean, we must recognise, but maybe there's something that can be done around that to try and induce a little bit more of that travelling.
Yeah. Dan, your thoughts on, other thoughts on in the sort of public policy space? We talked a little bit about, transport. Where else would you with the literature and your understanding, where would that point us towards in terms of thinking about policy interventions to underpin, or at least not to undermine, the benefits of agglomeration that we see in London? What else matters?
I mean, I think transport's the obvious one that we've got, pretty direct control over. And the literature on ridership in public transport systems, for instance, shows that things like quality of service make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. So I think, maintaining good levels of frequency, making sure we've not got overcrowded systems, is really important. Fares are also important, but that is a tricky business for all sorts of reasons. I think it would be wrong to start making decisions about long-run investments in transport on the basis of what we're seeing now. So we've got to recognise that, connectivity in the economy has huge advantages. I mean, there's evidence from all over the world. Good, strong statistical evidence shows investing in transport systems, not so much roads actually, but investing in mass transit systems and railways has a great effect on the economy. It induces productivity gains for all sorts of reasons, but largely because it just makes things more efficient. It makes stuff easier to do, and therefore more of it happens when it's easier to do.
Yeah.
So I think we need to think about frequency of service. We need to make sure our transport systems work efficiently, are resilient, are reliable. We need to think of the price of those systems, and we need not to think, okay, we don't need investments anymore in the future. That would be wrong.
And it's that long-term point, isn't it? That's the real issue. I mean, not least how bad we are at delivering long-term transport infrastructure investments. It takes us forever to do.
Yeah.
But if we're in a position now, it takes us ages to do anyway, but we're having sort of we're in a three-year period currently, and we don't know how long that's going to extend further, where there may be a belief that, well, we don't need to invest in this transport infrastructure anymore because people aren't going to travel so much. And people do then come back to work on a more frequent basis. I mean, that stores up problems for the future. So thinking about discussions around the requirement for Crossrail 2 or the Bakerloo line extension, we need to be careful that at least we should be reflective on these things all of the time. But that reflection should be done on data and strong theory rather than just, well, I don't think that people are going to come back in anymore, so yeah, we're not going to take that forward. Yeah. And that's a big risk, I think, for not just, again, not just for London, but actually the other big cities in the UK, where actually you could argue that their transport infrastructure is much less developed. And it's not just for there about getting them back to pre-COVID levels, but it's about trying to induce much greater modal shift to try and improve how their economies work.
Let's finish on that. It's an unfair question, but I'll ask it, and you two can just tell me it's unfair, and then we'll finish. But in a sense, we talked about the moment that we're in. We're recording this in mid-May 2023, there or thereabouts. We've recognized that there's been quite a significant amount of change over the last few years. Some trends that we'd seen around the ways of working, essentially, we've seen more change in 3 years than we have probably in 30 years in some respects. So period of uncertainty, we both talked about thinking about the short and the long term, difficult to make decisions now that are durable over many decades. How should we think about that change? When is it that we think that it will be right to say, actually, what we now are observing are persistent and consistent, and we should no longer think about further big significant change? Where we are is where we are. Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? That's a tough question, Dan. I mean, how should we think about that? Because we can't make decisions now based on a couple of years. I fully agree with that. Do we say the same thing after 3 years, after 5 years, after 7 years? Notwithstanding that all of this might change, but how do we think about the sort of time aspect in the public policy space?
I mean, it's hard to put a precise figure on it. I think sounds like I'm avoiding the question, but there's an important point made in the report about real estate, for instance, which is that leases don't change immediately, so there is a lag effect in terms of the decision making process. I mean, I would think assuming we don't have another pandemic, in around 5 years, we'll begin to know how things look. And I personally think that for a city like London, which has a high share of professional, creative, you know, service sector based jobs, I mean, looking at the kind of evidence that's coming out in academic literature, so blame my colleagues for this prediction, but we'll probably see a downturn resurgence. So the city centre will be pretty strong 5 years from now.
So I think I've gone on record in the past saying that we should look 2 to 3 years beyond when restrictions have been lifted. And that was to agree to a degree to finger in the air. But that's where I've sort of stuck myself to say, well, actually, let's see what may, or at least do an assessment of what's going on that far out, rather than, you know, making assessments, you know, within the eye of a crisis, which is never a good time to try and project from. So when did we, I think the restrictions were lifted sort of early 2022-ish, I believe. So we're about a year in to that now. So, you know, this time, somewhere between this time next year and this time after, so let's say May 2025, let's go. I'll give myself that extra wiggle room, say 3 years. May 2025, I think, is a good time to come back at this again and assess and see what is going on, and whether we think we have reached an equilibrium, whether we've seen a flat landing in the data, or whether we've seen a continuous improvement.
Well, in that case, I'll have you both back in 2 or 3 years' time, and we can see what, you know, where we are then. My guests today have been Dan Graham and Paul Swinney. Thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.